Chapter 7. Race and Slavery. Slavery until recently was universal in two senses. Most settled societies incorporated the institution into their social structures, and few peoples in the world have not constituted a major source of slaves at one time or another. David Eltis. Although slavery in the United States was referred to as a peculiar institution, slavery was, in fact, one of the oldest and most widespread institutions on Earth. Slavery existed in the Western Hemisphere before Columbus's ships appeared on the horizon, and it existed in Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East for thousands of years. Slavery was older than Islam, Buddhism, or Christianity, and both the secular and religious moralists of societies around the world accepted human bondage, not only as a fact of life, but as something requiring no special moral justification. Slavery was peculiar in the United States only because human bondage was inconsistent with the principles on which this nation was founded. Historically, however, it was those principles which were peculiar, not slavery. Although slavery has come to be identified with the enslavement of Africans, that too ignores the long history and vast scope of the institution. The very word slave is derived from the Slavs, who were enslaved on a massive scale and were often sold into bondage all across the continent of Europe and in the Ottoman Empire. The Arabic word for slave likewise derives from the Arabic word for Slavs, as did the word for slave in German, Dutch, French, Spanish, and Italian. Nor were the Slavs the only Europeans enslaved. In just one raid on the Balearic Islands off the east coast of Spain, the famous pirate Barbarossa carried off thousands of Christians into slavery, and after a later raid on Venice, the booty he brought back included, in addition to such things as cloth and money, 1,000 girls and 1,500 boys. Europeans living in vulnerable coastal settlements in the Balkans were likewise raided by pirates and were carried off by the tens of thousands to be sold in the slave markets of North Africa and the Middle East. Russians, by the hundreds of thousands, were sold into the international slave trade by Turkic raiders before a strong Russian state and then empire was consolidated and able to resist these incursions. Slavery was at one time common all across the continent of Europe, and as late as 1776, Adam Smith wrote that slavery still existed in Russia, Poland, Hungary, and in parts of Germany. Indeed, that Western Europe was the only region of the world where slavery had been abolished altogether. In the 16th century, peace terms imposed by the Ottoman Turks required the defeated Hungarians to send them 10% of their population each decade as slaves. It was common for the Ottomans to requisition a certain number of boys from among conquered European populations, these boys to be taken into the service of the imperial government. In the 18th century, immigrant German farm communities on the lower Volga were raided by Mongol tribesmen and the captured Germans taken off to be sold in the slave markets of Asia. In the 1820s, 6,000 Greeks were sent to Egypt as slaves, and half a century later, a report to the British Parliament noted that both white and black slaves were still being traded in Egypt and Turkey, years after blacks had been emancipated in the United States. Slavery was likewise common in Asia. The Manchus raided China, Korea, and Mongolia for slaves. Raiders from the Sulu Archipelago, in what is now the Philippines, conducted large-scale expeditions to capture people as slaves across wide reaches of Southeast Asia. Slavery of various kinds was also common in India, where the original thugs often murdered parents in order to get their children and sell them into bondage. Organized slave markets and international shipments of slaves were also common in Asia. Slaves from India were shipped to Java, and Indonesian slaves were shipped as far away as South Africa. Despite its reputation as an island paradise, Bali lost many thousands of its people as slaves, most being shipped off to other parts of Southeast Asia. Smaller or less advanced groups were set upon by marauders in many parts of Asia, as they were in other parts of the world. Hill tribes, nomadic peoples, bands of hunters and gatherers, or primitive slash-and-burn agriculturalists, being set upon by those who had reached more advanced stages of development and who had more advanced weapons. This pattern was common for centuries in Cambodia, Malaya, the Philippines, Burma, or the islands of Indonesia or New Guinea. Many peoples around the world, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, for example, exempted themselves from enslavement while engaging in the enslavement of others. This left as prey those peoples in societies too small or too weak to defend themselves. Many such societies remained in sub-Saharan Africa, often in small isolated villages, after most of Europe, Asia, and the Middle East had been consolidated into nations too powerful to be victimized in this way. In Africa as well, people from powerful warrior tribes, such as the Maasai, were rarely enslaved. Sub-Saharan Africa was unique only in remaining vulnerable longer. Where black Africans were themselves powerful, they often used that power to enslave their weaker neighbors, both for their own use and for sale to Europeans. Conversely, in regions of Europe where there were vulnerable peoples without the military protection of strong nation-states, as on the Adriatic coast, for example, these peoples were raided and enslaved for at least twice as long as the 300 years of slavery in the United States. Only after the consolidation of political power in that region and the Catholic Church's intervention after the peoples of the Balkans had accepted Christianity for centuries did the enslavement of Bosnians and others stop, and the Europeans then turned their attention toward Africa as an alternative source of supply. Over the centuries, somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 million people were shipped across the Atlantic from Africa as slaves, and another 14 million African slaves were taken across the Sahara Desert or shipped through the Persian Gulf and other waterways to the nations of North Africa and the Middle East. Significant proportions of both massive streams of slaves did not live to complete the journey. Mortality rates were even higher among those who were walked across the burning sands of the Sahara than among those subjected to the horrors and dangers of the Atlantic crossing. On the Saharan route, several Africans were enslaved for everyone who reached the Mediterranean alive. Nor were these 25 million human beings the only victims of slavery. Africa itself used large numbers of slaves in all sorts of agricultural, domestic, military, and even commercial and governmental enterprises. Numbers never reached the same magnitudes in Southeast Asia, for example, where there was simply not the large demand for slaves that existed in the Ottoman Empire or in the Western Hemisphere. Supply alone cannot explain the existence or magnitude of slavery. There also had to be a demand from other societies, wealthy and powerful enough, to have a use for large numbers of people to work in its fields, mines, homes, or other places. Although North African and Middle Eastern nations dominated the slave trade from Africa for centuries before the Europeans appeared on the scene, the latter's insatiable demand for slave labor for their Western Hemisphere colonies caused the slave exports across the Atlantic to exceed, during its era, even the massive shipments of human beings from Africa into the Islamic world. During this era of European domination of the slave trade from Africa, about four times as many Africans as Europeans arrived in the Western Hemisphere in the centuries from the time of Columbus's voyages until 1820. It was only the fact that the slave trade to the Islamic countries began earlier and continued longer that made the Middle East and North Africa the largest absorber of black Africans as slaves over the centuries. Moreover, it is only the existence of a vastly greater literature on slavery in the Western world than in the Islamic world, which creates the myopic illusion that slavery, or even African slavery, was a predominantly European phenomenon. For slavery to be understood as a global phenomenon, it must be analyzed beyond any particular national background. And yet, in the light of numerous real national and historical settings, rather than as an abstract model, to explain slavery as being a consequence of certain European ideas leading to bondage for Africans is to ignore the glaring fact that slavery extended in time and space far beyond Europeans and Africans, and far beyond those who shared particular European ideas. Nor can a certain crop, such as sugar, be regarded as some kind of key to understanding slavery, even in the Western Hemisphere, where millions of slaves worked on sugarcane plantations in South America and the Caribbean, for other millions toiled in the cotton fields of the southern United States. Worldwide, still more vast numbers of slaves worked in an enormous range of occupations, from the harems and military units of the Middle East to the clove plantations of Zanzibar, the coffee plantations of Yemen, the pearl fisheries of the Red Sea, and in mines from Egypt to Burma, as well as in high government posts in the Ottoman Empire, where enslaved eunuchs especially could acquire fearsome power. To make some sense of this chaotic complexity, it is necessary to recognize that the stark dichotomy of freedom and slavery concealed degrees and varieties which must be understood in order to understand the phenomenon as a whole. Gradations of slavery. Clearly, the circumstances of a plantation slave, laboring under a tropical sun in the sugarcane fields, and with the threat of the lash ever present, were radically different from the circumstances of a slave who advised a sultan of the Ottoman Empire on high government policy, or who ruled a province or led an army into battle. Even within a given society, such as the antebellum South in the United States, the circumstances of slaves varied from the classic plantation field hand to urban slaves who often led day-to-day lives not very different from those of ordinary employees, often choosing both their own housing and their own employers, while paying a share of their earnings to their owners. This practice of slaves hiring themselves out to various employers also existed among slaves in ancient Roman society, and in more recent centuries in Southeast Asia. While the descendants of slaves carried an indelible stigma for generations in some countries, the male offspring of the Ottoman Sultan's harem became his heirs, including his successors as Sultan in the Ottoman Empire. In Southeast Asia, Chinese immigrants, overwhelmingly male, often took local slave women as concubines, in some cases selling them again in later years when the men returned to China, taking their children with them. In other cases, where the original intention to return to China faded away over the years, the concubines might become the wives of those men who remained. Among European men sojourning in Southeast Asia, it was more common to set the women free when the men returned to Europe alone. Clearly, slavery has existed in a very wide range of modifications, so much so that some scholars have spent much time trying to determine where slavery ended and other forms of bondage and dependency began, especially in non-Western societies where words and practices varied in ways not easy to discern. Rather than attempt the impossible task of exploring all the modifications of slavery, we can examine the characteristics of a few disparate forms of the institution. The simplest and purest form of slavery is that of the laborer working under the immediate and complete control and direction of some overseer with the arbitrary power of summary punishment. This was the fate of millions of slaves throughout the Western Hemisphere, where the harshness of their conditions was such that few slave populations reproduced themselves, and most had to be replenished with new captives from Africa. Literally working slaves to death has been a practice recurring in a number of very disparate settings, such as in the building of infrastructure in Iraq or in the Nazi slave labor camps in World War II. In some societies in Asia, Africa, and the Western Hemisphere, slaves were deliberately killed as human sacrifices. In ancient Rome, slave gladiators killed each other in the Colosseum for the amusement of the spectators, and in other societies around the world, slave owners arbitrarily killed slaves, sometimes in sadistic ways, with impunity. It seems almost inconceivable that slaves could have ranged from this abject level of debasement and dehumanization to wealthy and powerful men who ruled over free populations and commanded armies. In between were slaves who were craftsmen, teachers, doctors, and, in at least one case, a black captain of a Mississippi riverboat with a racially mixed crew in the antebellum South. Both within and between societies, there was a systematic relationship between the kinds of work that slaves did and the way they were treated, a fact with wider and deeper implications for the use of power in general. Although slaves were subject to the virtually unlimited arbitrary power of slave owners in many societies, often de facto, even in societies which recognized no such right de jure, many slave owners nevertheless found it expedient to use other incentives than force, including money, autonomy, and even the granting of civil or military power, to get slaves to carry out responsibilities of a higher and more demanding nature. Nothing could more clearly indicate the limited ability of even unbridled power to accomplish all its objectives. Where those objectives were simply the growing and processing of sugar or cotton, or the mining of salt or other minerals, then pure, stark, and brutal slavery was sufficient to accomplish these objectives. But where the work required somewhat more individual attention and discretion, as in the growing and processing of tobacco, or the performing of domestic chores, some relaxation of the strictest slavery became apparent. Ironically, slaves in poorer societies in Southeast Asia were often treated more mildly than in more advanced commercial and industrial societies, where mass production agriculture or mining absorbed vast numbers of regimented slaves. It was not a difference between European and Asian slavery, as such, that was crucial, but rather the nature of the work. Manacled skeletons of men have been found in a Burma mine, and human sacrifice was a practice among various Asian peoples, with those sacrificed being more likely to be recent captives rather than slaves of long service. Among the Circassian women who were prized as concubines in the harems of the Ottoman Empire, their treatment was sufficiently mild to cause mothers to deliberately train their daughters for this role, and to sell them into bondage in the harems of wealthy Ottoman men, from which they often emerged later with advantageous marriages, having been arranged for them by their owners. As higher and higher levels of responsibility and discretion were required of slaves, they were treated less and less like slaves, so that this status became virtually nominal for those who held wealth and power as advisors or viceroys of Ottoman rulers, for example. Not all societies permitted slaves to rise to high positions, and in many societies it was taboo to permit slaves to use arms. Weapons, like money or education, were a two-edged sword. They increased the range and value of the tasks that could be performed by slaves, while at the same time providing means to facilitate their escape. The nature of the social, military, and other circumstances determined where the point of balance might be for a given slave-owning society. In the Western Hemisphere, for example, education was in many places explicitly forbidden by law. To make some sense of the vast numbers and almost chaotic varieties of slavery, it will be necessary to analyze in some systematic way the economic and social incentives and constraints within which slavery existed, the social consequences of this institution, and some of the broader implications of its existence and demise. What must be explained is not the rise of slavery, which predates history, but why it ended, and why it varied as it did during its existence. Pure slavery. Before considering some of the modifications of slavery, and the reasons for those modifications, it is necessary to look at simple, unmodified slavery, to see which of its characteristics and limitations made modification useful to the slave-owning societies, and under what conditions. While 100% pure unmodified slavery may never have existed, any more than 100% pure capitalism, socialism, or feudalism ever existed, the concept is a useful starting point. Moreover, for many of the slaves who toiled in the sugarcane and cotton fields of the Western Hemisphere, what they experienced was in fact painfully close to 100% pure slavery. The economics of slavery. Like all economic institutions and activities, slavery had costs and benefits. While the benefits of slavery went predominantly to people who were not slaves, and the costs were paid predominantly by people subjected to bondage, there were also costs to the capture of slaves, and more costs to the maintenance of slavery as a system. Moreover, these costs were different when the enslaved population was racially distinct from the free population. In ancient Rome, individual Romans might be reduced to slavery as punishment for transgressions, but ordinary slaves were non-Romans captured in battle or acquired in trade. Similarly, in a later era, it was common for the Ottoman Empire to enslave Europeans or Africans, as it was common for some African tribes to enslave others, or for people in Asia to enslave both non-Asians and Asians belonging to a different race or class from themselves. In short, except for debt bondage or bondage as punishment, the process of enslavement has generally been one of enslaving outsiders of one sort or another, whether by race, religion, nationality, or other characteristics. For centuries in Europe, it was considered legitimate for the Christians of Western Europe to enslave pagans from the Balkans or Eastern Europe, and it was long after all of Europe became Christian that the Catholic Church finally insisted on an end to the pretense that European slaves were pagans. In short, the choice as to which outsiders to enslave was not a matter of racial ideology, but was based on pragmatic considerations as to availability, including both the military and legal obstacles to their enslavement. In ancient times, to attempt to raid the Roman Empire to acquire Romans as slaves was likely to prove costly in both immediate terms of armed resistance and in terms of provoking retaliatory raids and warfare from Rome. Such considerations not only determined which groups were more likely to become slaves and which were more likely to be slave masters as of a given time, but also suggest why continued enslavement of particular populations became less common with the rise of powerful nation-states. Turkish enslavement of peoples in the Caucasus continued until the Caucasus was conquered by the Russians and incorporated into the Russian Empire. Isolated slave raids might occur afterwards, but for the Ottoman Empire to attempt mass enslavement of subjects of the Russian Empire was to risk war. The consolidation of nation-states around the world reduced the number of places from which people could be captured and enslaved. Long after it was no longer feasible for one nation-state to challenge another by attempting to enslave its people, freelance pirates and similar marauders on land were not deterred by such considerations, and continued to make raids to acquire slaves in Southeast Asia, for example, particularly in remote and backward regions beyond the effective control of either indigenous or colonial governments. These pirates were sometimes Chinese, sometimes Arabs, sometimes Malays, or members of other groups from within or outside the region. Similarly, armed Arab freelance marauders moved into Central Africa in the 19th century and established their own settlements, acquiring slaves and other forms of wealth as tribute from the surrounding African communities. While pirates and comparable freelance operators on land were active in the capture of people for enslavement, the actual trading of slaves in the marketplace was often done by merchant peoples who treated slaves as simply an additional form of merchandise. Around the world, the slave trade was conducted by merchant peoples such as the Venetians, Greeks, and Jews in Europe, the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, or by the Arabs who played both the merchant and marauder roles in Africa, though even here, the same individual seldom handled the slave from initial capture to final sale. When Italian merchants began displacing Jewish merchants in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea in medieval times, they also began displacing Jews in the Black Sea slave trade. Another great merchant people, Gujaratis from India, often financed the African slave trade, though they did not usually conduct it. The Yao, a Central African tribe noted for being the leading traders of ivory in their region, likewise became the leading traders of slaves in that region. Neither a national policy nor a racial ideology was necessary for enslavement to take place. All that was necessary was the existence of vulnerable people, whoever and wherever they might be, and regardless of whether they were racially similar or different from those who victimized them. Slavery flourished in ancient Greece and Rome without any racial ideology. Vulnerable people were enslaved around the world and down through history. Sailors from Magellan's ships left stranded in Southeast Asia were sold into slavery by the local people. In Spain, the Moors sometimes enslaved Spaniards, and the Spaniards sometimes enslaved Moors, depending upon what the opportunities and the alternatives were. The various peoples living in the drainage basins of the Caspian Sea and Black Sea likewise captured one another to sell as slaves during the Middle Ages. In ancient times, Roman soldiers enslaved enemy captives and expected to be enslaved themselves if captured, and in fact, Romans enslaved in Carthage were repatriated after the war against Hannibal. An estimated 97,000 Jews were enslaved by the Romans as a result of war. Germans, Gauls, and Celts were also enslaved by the Romans. Enslavement was based on self-interest and opportunity, not ideology. Peoples regularly subjected to slave raids might indeed be despised and treated with contempt both during their enslavement and after their emancipation, but that was not what caused them to be enslaved in the first place. Although there was no religious basis for racism in the Islamic world, the massive enslavement of the sub-Saharan Africans by Arabs and other Muslims was followed by a racial disdain toward black people in the Middle East. But this racial disdain followed, rather than preceded, the enslavement of black Africans, and had not been apparent in the Arabs' previous dealings with Ethiopians. In the West as well, racism was promoted by slavery, rather than vice versa. Both in North America and in South Africa, racist rationales for slavery were resorted to only after religious rationales were tried and found wanting. But that is not to say that either rationale was in fact the reason for enslavement. In many other societies, no rationale was considered necessary. Africa remained prey to other nations, long after mass enslavement was no longer viable in many other parts of the world, because it remained vulnerable longer. Africa was, and is, the least urbanized continent and long contained many smaller, weaker, and more isolated peoples, who were prey to more powerful African tribes, such as the Ashanti and the Yao, as well as to Arab slave raiders. Many of the peoples victimized by the Arabs in Central Africa had lived isolated from the outside world and were easy prey for marauders with firearms, who seized their goods and such people as they wished, leaving behind famine brought on by looted granaries and diseases spread by caravans. Europeans became mass traders of African slaves, largely by purchase from Africa's more powerful tribes and empires. A particularly high cost prevented most Europeans, the Portuguese being an exception, from capturing Africans directly. The extreme vulnerability of Europeans to African diseases during the era of slavery. Before the use of quinine became widespread, the average life expectancy of a European in the interior of sub-Saharan Africa was less than 1 year. Most European slave traders therefore purchased Africans who had already been captured by others, typically by other Africans. The costs of slavery did not end with capture. There were various kinds of costs to maintaining the system, including the prevention of escape by those enslaved. Moreover, these costs had to be minimized, for the system was economically viable only so long as these costs did not exceed the benefits to the slave owners. Thus, while slaves could be manacled and chained while in transit, this was seldom practical when they were at their destinations and at work. Even to have them continuously surrounded by armed guards was not always economically feasible, and in fact this was seldom, if ever, done in the antebellum South. Nor was it common in the Ottoman Empire or in Southeast Asia. Instead, social and psychological means of control were used, backed up by brutal force against those individuals for whom these means did not suffice. Maintaining ignorance among slaves was one way of reducing the cost of maintaining slavery, particularly in societies where the work performed by slaves required no education. By ignorance is not meant here simply the absence of formal education, important as that sometimes was in deterring escape from the most brutal kinds of slavery without incurring high costs of having armed guards, but also an ignorance of the local geographical region. Enslaving people on their own home grounds was more likely to lead to successful attempts at escape than where they were enslaved far from familiar surroundings. Thus, when the Dutch controlled Java, they preferred to import slaves from outside Java, and preferably of diverse origins, to reduce the likelihood of conspiracies. When the British bought local slaves in Banten and tried to use them in a factory there, they found themselves losing their workforce through escapes. Conversely, Malay and Indonesian slaves were sometimes transported thousands of miles away to South Africa, at a time when Africans were being transported thousands of miles to the Western Hemisphere. It was not literally impossible for foreigners to enslave people in their own homelands, as some indigenous peoples were enslaved in the Western Hemisphere, for example. But it was sufficiently more costly to be the exception rather than the rule. When costs are defined as economists conceive costs, as foregone benefits, then there were additional and less visible costs to slave owners and to slave-owning societies, but very large costs nonetheless. In a system of relatively unmodified slavery, such as prevailed in the Western Hemisphere, the kinds of work done by slaves was limited by the need to maintain close control of a slave population that in some countries outnumbered the free population. The need to prevent escape and organized rebellion, and the maintenance of subordination in order to get the work done, precluded using slaves in a wide variety of otherwise productive activities requiring education, dispersal, or the use of money or arms. These foregone opportunities to develop and exploit the talents and potentialities of slaves in ways that were done in other slave societies under different conditions represented very large costs to the non-slave population, not only during the era of slavery, but even in the post-emancipation era, when millions of uneducated people were freed without the means of contributing as much as they could have to the larger society, as well as to their own maintenance and well-being. In short, pure unmodified slavery reduced the productivity of people with given capabilities, as well as reducing the capabilities that could be developed from people with given potentialities. Moreover, since each generation is raised by the generation before it, later free descendants of the enslaved population would be similarly handicapped in their own development, not only to their own detriment, but also to the detriment of the larger society in which they lived. Race-based slavery had still more costs. Obviously, the cost of maintaining slavery and preventing escapes would be lower if the slaves were isolated individuals with no connection to one another and no incentives to aid one another against the slave owners. Just as the Dutch in Java preferred slaves of diverse origins, so in parts of the Western Hemisphere, Africans from a mixture of tribes, speaking different languages, were preferred for the same reasons. In the United States, however, as the most distant of the slave plantation societies from Africa, the higher cost of importing new slaves led to a largely native-born black population as early as colonial times, and this population consisted of families and people who knew each other and who spoke the same language. Moreover, the free black population had varying degrees of racial solidarity with the slaves, and in various ways could make the maintenance of the slave system more costly. The most obvious way in which free blacks could impose costs on the slave system was by directly helping slaves escape. Some free blacks did this, as did some sympathetic whites, either individually or in an organized fashion, through the so-called Underground Railroad that enabled slaves to escape from the South to the free states. Other deliberate actions, such as encouraging escapes or supplying information on escape routes, also raised the cost of the slave system. Moreover, free blacks raised the cost of maintaining slavery by their very existence, whether or not they took any active role in undermining it. Slaves seeing other members of their own race enjoying freedom were, of course, more likely to be disgruntled, creating morale and productivity problems, even if this discontent did not lead to escape. Slaveholders were, of course, well aware of all this and tried to make the areas in the vicinity of slave plantations inhospitable to free blacks. All sorts of discriminatory legislation and practices sought to reduce the freedom of free blacks, to humble them publicly, by making them get off the sidewalks to make way for white pedestrians, for example, and otherwise make their lives less attractive to blacks still held in bondage. Such restrictions and harassments were far more common in those parts of the South dominated by slave plantations than in southern cities or in other regions of the South where plantations were less common. Had such policies reflected nothing but pure and simple racism, they might have been expected to be either uniform or to vary in a pattern unrelated to slave plantations. But in fact, the special harshness of restrictions on free blacks in the region where antebellum slave plantations were concentrated had the desired effect of causing them to relocate away from such regions, to move toward the cities and toward the Upper South and the North. The net result was that, while the geographic center of the slave population tended to move southwestward at an average rate of nearly 50 miles per decade for nearly a century, toward land more suitable for cotton production, the free persons of color were almost evenly split between North and South, with their proportions in the Deep South declining. One of the ways in which free blacks inadvertently raised the cost of slavery was by acting as a source of literacy to slaves. Most free blacks in the United States were literate in 1850, despite being excluded from public schools in many parts of the country, and despite being forbidden to establish their own schools in much of the South. Since ignorance was a key part of the slave security system in a plantation slave society, any access to knowledge was seen as a threat to the subordination inherent in slavery, as a source of discontent, and as an aid to escape. Therefore, this particular system of slavery had to pay a high price in lost productivity by keeping slaves ignorant. The Southern society as a whole also had to pay a price in restricting the education of 250,000 or more free blacks, even if these restrictions were not as effective as they wished. While knowledge that would be useful in making escapes was repressed, slavery made investment in the manual skills of slaves more profitable than similar investments by an employer of free labor. After an employer incurs the costs of training an employee in some manual craft, that employee can later decide to go to work elsewhere, causing the original employer to lose some of the benefits of his investment in training. Even if the employee remains, part of the investment can be lost meeting demands for higher wages, reflecting the greater value of the worker. And not meeting those demands would, of course, increase the incentives for the employee to go work for someone else. Neither of these problems existed for slaveholders, since slaves were in no position to demand wages, nor could most of them choose to work for someone else. Moreover, if the slave were to be sold later, he could be sold for a higher price as a skilled craftsman, thereby recouping the investment. The net result of these incentives was that manual skills were common among the enslaved black population of the South, where plantations were more or less self-sufficient little worlds of their own, requiring a variety of skills. Moreover, these skills carried over into the occupations of many free persons of color during the era of slavery and afterward. Black craftsmen were long common in the South, as was the case in other parts of the Western Hemisphere, and skilled slaves of various racial backgrounds were common in other slave societies around the world, ancient and modern. Very wide ranges of skills and talents were cultivated among various classes of slaves, especially in those societies where the demographic or other circumstances made organized slave revolts less likely. in addition to administrative, political, and military skills developed among male slaves in the Ottoman Empire, those female slaves who were used as concubines for elite men were often trained in music and in social skills. In short, a society with massive plantations manned by slaves of a different race, and often larger numbers, than themselves, operated with more restricted options than a society where the free population had less reason to fear for its own safety and had less need to maintain strict and brutal control to get its work done. Societies with slave populations of racially and linguistically heterogeneous origins, often predominantly female, obviously had far wider options in the occupational use of slaves and the degree to which they could be educated and their talents exploited. Whether or not specialized skills were involved, slaves were a capital investment in slave societies in general. That is, the current market value of slaves reflected an anticipated future stream of income, or value in kind, from their services. This market value, however, varied enormously from one part of the world to another, and the treatment of slaves tended to vary with this market value. The cost of a slave in the American South was about 30 times the cost of a slave on the coast of Africa, for example. Part of this differential reflected the cost of transportation, including the risk of death en route, and part reflected the fact that slaves in the United States were sufficiently familiar with their tasks and roles as to be more valuable workers than new slaves who would require training. In a country much closer to Africa, such as Brazil, where slave prices were accordingly cheap, slaves might be worked to death and then replaced by new arrivals. But this was too costly to be done in the United States. On the contrary, it was common for Southern slaveholders to hire white workers, often Irish immigrants, to do work considered too dangerous for slaves. The greater capital value of slaves in the United States was also reflected in the lower infant mortality rates among children born to slave women in the South, as compared to infant mortality rates among children born to slave women in the Caribbean or South America. The cost of lower infant mortality rates was a reduced workload for the mother, both before and after giving birth, and some provision for the care of the child during the years when his consumption exceeded any economic contribution that he could make to the slaveholder. In countries where new adult male slaves from Africa were more readily available, these costs were less often incurred. Given the different economic circumstances of slavery in different countries, it is not surprising that the infant mortality rate among black slaves in the West Indies was several times as high as in the American South, or that the Brazilian plantation slave population was overwhelmingly male, with a few females often being kept locked up at night to prevent their getting pregnant. The more humane laws in Latin American slave societies have led many to conclude that the treatment of slaves was better there than in societies lacking such legal protection of slaves, such as the United States. However, laws are by no means the only constraint on the treatment of slaves, nor a priori the most effective constraint. For a slave to presume to avail himself of such laws was to risk devastating punishment, whether in North or South America, or in the Middle East or Asia, for that matter. Economics often had much more influence on the treatment of slaves. Slave prices were responsive to supply and demand, like the prices of inanimate merchandise or the prices of livestock. In Southeast Asia, the prices of male and female slaves were very similar before the arrival in the Straits settlements of large numbers of predominantly male Chinese immigrants in the 18th century. These Chinese men then created an increased demand for female slaves as concubines. Thereafter, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the prices of female slaves rose to become two or three times the prices of male slaves of the same age. European men living in the same region paid even higher prices for the more attractive of the slave women. In the Ottoman Empire, there was a hierarchy of slave prices, reflecting the varying demands and supplies. Because slaves were so often used for domestic purposes rather than for heavy labor in the Ottoman Empire, far more women than men were taken as slaves from Africa, so much so as to leave sexually unbalanced societies in parts of East Africa. African women were more likely to be used as housekeepers, while European women, and especially Circassian women, were more likely to be concubines. Slave prices reflected these conditions. Males were generally sold for less than females, and African females for less than Circassian females. The large exception was the price of eunuchs, which tended to be the highest of all, given that many men failed to survive castration and the prices of the survivors had to cover the cost of all those sacrificed. In other ways as well, the slave market exhibited the same economic principles as other markets. In Southeast Asia, when a demand for field laborers became more pronounced, slave raids became more common to supply that demand. In West Africa, the traditional practice among some warrior tribes of slaughtering male captives and enslaving the women and children, a practice common among other conquerors in other places, changed after the development of a European demand for male slaves for use in the Western Hemisphere made the enslavement of males profitable, with the traditional practice resuming after the suppression of the Atlantic slave trade. When the price of sugar declined in the 1840s, there was a decline in the exports of slaves from Mozambique, these slaves being largely destined for Brazil and other sugar-producing areas, which now had a lower demand for slaves. After the British Navy began patrolling the Indian Ocean to suppress the slave trade there, slaves began to be shipped in older and cheaper vessels, which would represent less of a loss if intercepted and confiscated by the British. In short, the basic principles of economics operated in the international markets for slaves. Values and costs are not independent abstractions. Something represents a value or a cost to some particular individuals, and only when those individuals are decision makers do these values and costs affect outcomes. The value of a slave's life to the slave himself is quite different from its value to a plantation owner, for example, and that in turn is different from its value to an overseer with limited tenure on a given plantation. Thus, slaves on plantations run by overseers, with the owner absent, were more likely to be overworked and their long-term maintenance neglected, like the long-term maintenance of buildings, equipment, and livestock. The overseer's incentive was to maximize output during his tenure, whether because he received a share of the proceeds or because his record for results was a long-term capital asset for him in seeking his next job. When the plantation owner lived on the plantation himself, his incentives included maintaining his own long-term capital assets, principally the slaves, but also the buildings, equipment, and livestock. And since the owner employed the overseer, his interests overrode those of the overseer, to the extent that the owner was in a position to know what was going on. Absentee owners, of course, had no such access to knowledge. One reason for the far higher infant mortality among blacks on West Indian slave plantations was that the owners of these plantations typically lived in London. While the children born to slaves might be a capital asset to the plantation owner in London, they represented only a reduction in plantation profits to the overseer on the scene. The economics of freedom. When people are viewed as capital assets, and when their potential productivity is reduced by the need to maintain slavery as a relatively unmodified system, then the purely economic value of that asset can differ considerably, according to whether a given individual works as a slave or a free worker. Even in the absence of a desire for freedom, the capital value of the same individual would tend to be higher as a free worker than as a slave, simply because a wider range of economic options is available for the use of free labor. Since capital assets in general tend to move through the marketplace from their lower valued uses to their higher valued uses, why did slaves not become free through the ordinary functioning of economic incentives? Since others can own the value of an individual as a slave, but only the given individual himself can own the capital value of his work as a free person, economic logic would lead to each individual's becoming the highest bidder for himself, since his higher value as a free worker would enable him to bid more than his value as a slave. The poverty of the slave was not an insurmountable obstacle, since various credit institutions have enabled slaves to purchase their own freedom in both ancient and modern slave societies. Self-purchase was common in ancient Greece and Rome, often happened in Latin America, and happened sometimes in the Islamic countries and in the antebellum southern United States. Government intervention, however, prevented mass self-emancipation through self-purchase in the marketplace in the antebellum South, where state governments increasingly restricted all forms of manumission of slaves, as did authorities in various other slave societies, ancient and modern. Such government intervention reflected the fact that, while the sale of freedom might be mutually beneficial to the slave and the slave owner, there were substantial external costs to the surrounding society. Given the repression of the slaves' development in the antebellum South, their presence as members of a free society would impose direct costs on that society, as well as indirect costs to maintaining the slave system for those remaining in bondage. Accordingly, in the decades leading up to the Civil War, the ability of a slaveholder to free his own slaves was progressively restricted by law, to prevent his externalizing the cost of slavery by freeing people who had not been prepared for freedom. Even those antebellum Southerners convinced of the wrongness of slavery, such as Congressman John Randolph of Roanoke, were baffled by the dilemma as to what to do about it, since it was part of the world into which they had been born, making the question as to whether it should have been instituted in the first place a moot point for those now making decisions. While Congressman Randolph opposed the abolitionists politically, fearing a race war if slavery were abolished, instead of being allowed to die out, his will not only freed his own slaves, but bought land for them to live on in the free state of Ohio. Others tried to deal with the dilemma by plans to send freed slaves back to Africa, though in fact most of these slaves had never seen Africa, and neither had their parents or grandparents. Modified slavery. Even during the era of plantation slavery in the Western Hemisphere, there was work more complicated or more subtle than the routine drudgery of the sugarcane or cotton fields, and to get this work done by slaves required modifications of slavery itself. Sheer brute force was sufficient to get routine work done, where its performance was easily monitored by an overseer armed with a whip and able to administer punishment on the spot, but not all work was so easily monitored, and for this kind of work, some of the incentives of a non-slave economy were introduced. The most obvious example of this different kind of work would be domestic service, where the alacrity, attentiveness, and pleasantness of the servants were at least as important as the mere physical performance of the chores themselves. The care of small children, as well as adjustments to the varying moods of the slaveholder and other members of his family, were things not easily defined or mechanically monitored, though obviously very important. Moreover, the constant administration of punishment could disturb the tranquility and harmony of the slaveholder's own family, quite aside from backlashes from domestic slaves in a position to retaliate secretly in ways that might range up to arson or poison. It was a common feature of slave systems, whether in the antebellum South, in Southeast Asia, or in the Ottoman Empire, that domestic slaves were treated better than plantation slaves. In regions of the world where it was not feasible to grow plantation crops, slavery might often take forms very much modified from the pure slavery associated with mass production, routine tasks. Where the slaves were of different races from one another, black slaves and white slaves in the Ottoman Empire being classic examples, racial solidarity among the slaves was less of a factor to be considered, especially in societies where other social divisions were more salient than race, such as religion in Islamic countries. Throughout the Caribbean and South America, racial solidarity was systematically undermined by making many legal and social distinctions among the African ancestry population, according to their degree of racial mixture with whites. In continental North America, the white population was sufficiently larger and more dominant over the black population that such divide-and-conquer strategies were unnecessary. Given the virtually unlimited power of slave owners over slaves in the Western Hemisphere, including in practice the power of life and death, since the death of a slave from brutal punishment was unlikely to lead to a conviction for murder, it is remarkable how many incentives other than punishment were resorted to in order to get particular kinds of non-routine work done by slaves. The implications of this reach beyond slavery, for this pattern suggests the limitations of what can be accomplished by power alone. Power is inherently limited by knowledge. As already noted, an overseer could run a plantation in such a way as to maximize his own interests at the expense of the interests of the absentee owner. Similarly, domestic servants who took care of the babies, the food, and the household of slave owners could likewise secretly retaliate through theft, arson, or poison. More fundamentally, from an economic standpoint, what an overseer could monitor was work performance, but not work potential. Punishment required norms, and these norms had to be set at levels that were feasible. Otherwise, slaves whose punishment was inevitable because of their inability to meet the norms had little incentive even to try. But other slaves who were capable of doing more than these lowest common denominator norms had no incentives to do so under pure slavery. Modifications of slavery were ways of eliciting more of the hidden potential of slaves. A woman with a talent for dealing with children might become a trusted and privileged mammy on a southern slave plantation, or a man with a gift for military operations might become a soldier or even an officer in the armies of the Ottoman Empire. Pay, bonuses, and privileges were ways of extracting more from slaves than could be extracted by force alone, for these were essentially ways of inducing slaves to reveal their hidden capabilities. In resorting to these non-slave incentives, however, the benefits to the individual slaveholder could conflict with the needs of maintaining slavery as a system, and in particular, a system that was pervasively a plantation system of virtually pure slavery. Just as the examples of freed blacks undermined the acceptance or resignation of slaves to their lot in life, so the examples of privileged slaves contributed to discontent among the masses still dealt with as beasts of burden. A given slaveholder might consider it to his own advantage to indulge his house servants in learning to read and write, but literacy could spread readily, not only to his field hands, but also to slaves on other plantations in the vicinity, making escapes easier and costly precautions and recapture efforts necessary. Accordingly, numerous laws were passed in the antebellum South to prevent individual slaveholders from benefiting themselves by actions which imposed costs on the slave society as a whole. Laws against teaching slaves to read and write were an obvious example, but there were many others. Laws regulating urban slavery were especially numerous and especially ineffective, as the same laws were passed again and again in the same communities, the local authorities apparently being unaware that what they were trying to forbid had already been forbidden years earlier, but without effect. Urban slaves were usually domestic servants, and because they were in cities, had wider access to uncontrolled contacts with others than on plantations. One symptom of this freer movement was that urban slaves were more successful in making permanent escapes than were slaves on plantations. Because most plantation slaves were not kept under armed guard, temporary escapes were relatively easy and relatively frequent in the antebellum South, but their lack of knowledge of the wider world, their inability to read, much less to read a map, meant that most escapees were readily recaptured and then punished. Despite the existence of the Underground Railroad, most of the slaves who escaped permanently came from within 100 miles of a non-southern state in which they could find freedom. Urban slaves were much more likely to be able to read or write, since it was costlier to monitor their movements and activities in a city. Moreover, they were more likely to have social contacts among free blacks in the cities. This not only led to more escapes, it led to better treatment in order to forestall escapes. It was this better treatment which included allowing slaves relatively free movement around southern cities and even social interactions with whites in drinking establishments frequented by prostitutes that outraged southern white public opinion, for such behavior undermined the racial subordination which made slavery possible at relatively low cost. Accordingly, laws requiring slaveholders to maintain tighter control of their slaves were passed in cities across the South and were ineffective in these cities, because both the slaveholders and the slaves had incentives to behave otherwise, and policing numerous urban residences was not feasible for city governments. The net result, as Frederick Douglass put it, was that the urban slave was almost a free citizen. Douglass knew this from personal experience as an urban slave before he escaped to the North to become a leader of his people. The line between slavery and freedom was particularly tenuous for those urban slaves who worked for an employer and simply paid the slaveholder a share of their wages. Such slaves might live separately from the slaveholder's home and even change employers at will. Perhaps the most striking indication of the erosion of racial lines in urban settings was the much higher proportion of mulatto babies born to black women in antebellum southern cities as compared to black women on plantations. An estimated 1 to 2% of the babies born to plantation slave women were fathered by white men, compared to nearly half in the cities. Southern cities of that era had a chronic surplus of white men over white women and a chronic surplus of black women over black men. Similar sexual imbalances have led to mixed offspring in many other times and societies, so the antebellum South was not exceptional in this. If most of the slave women who gave birth to racially mixed babies were simply raped by their owners, then such babies would undoubtedly have been more common on the plantations, where white control was greatest, rather than in the cities, where it was more lax. Not all modifications of slavery in the antebellum South were due to urban residents. Some modifications were due to the nature of the work itself. Slaves working in lumbering which required both dispersion and initiative, unlike plantation work, were given more freedom and financial incentives, with no slave driving by overseers even being attempted. Similarly, slaves working in diving operations in the Carolina swamps, where the skill, discretion, and initiative of the diver were crucial, likewise had slave driving replaced by financial incentives. Virginia tobacco factories also used financial incentives and greater personal freedom to get work done that required attentiveness and intelligence, though the lax treatment of these slaves caused a political backlash from other white Southerners, who saw this as undermining the slave system as a whole. In parts of the world where plantation slavery was more rare, there was less concern that modifications of slavery for some would undermine the more rigorous discipline of the plantation slaves of others. In much of the Ottoman Empire, for example, where slavery was usually domestic slavery rather than a system of crop production, the treatment of slaves was generally more lenient than in plantation societies, and a wider range of occupations were open to them under modifications of slavery that extended all the way to using slaves as both civil and military officials. The women of the harems were slaves, with Circassian women from the Caucasus being particularly prized as concubines, and African women being used more often for domestic chores. The treatment of the Circassian women was sufficiently good that mothers in the Caucasus often voluntarily turned their daughters over to wealthy Ottoman men for their harems, after which these women could be freed and advantageous marriages arranged for them. A concubine who gave birth to a son for her owner might even be freed and become his wife. The wealthiest and most powerful slaves were the eunuchs, who could rise to high positions in the Ottoman government if their skills and talents warranted. Often they were put into positions of high trust in preference to a normal man, who might become ambitious to overthrow the rulers and establish his own dynasty, the latter option obviously not being open to eunuchs. In short, modifications of slavery were both widespread and far-reaching in the Ottoman Empire. Some have attributed the generally better treatment of slaves in this region to a more humane Islamic code. However, the Arabs' treatment of newly captured slaves en route to their destinations in North Africa and the Middle East was at least as harsh and cruel as that of slaves crossing the Atlantic en route to bondage in the Western Hemisphere. Indeed, the mortality rate of slaves crossing the Sahara was much higher than that of slaves on the dreadful and dangerous Atlantic crossing. The treatment of these slaves was considered appalling by observers, ranging from the Christian missionary explorer David Livingstone to the battle-hardened military ruler Muhammad Ali. Yet these Arabs were Muslims, just as were those who eventually bought these slaves and typically treated them better. Nor was ill treatment confined to the period of transit under slave traders. It was said that no slave survived in the Ottoman Empire Sahara salt mines for more than 5 years. The dimensions of treatment are many, and all slaves were not treated alike, even in a given society. African women in the Islamic lands were less likely to be freed than European women, and had little to look forward to except drudgery as long as they lived, without even a family life of their own. More African women than men were enslaved in the Islamic world, just the opposite of the situation among Africans taken in bondage to the slave societies of the Western Hemisphere, and these women were typically restricted from having sexual contact with men. The net result was that relatively few black children were born in the Middle East, and few of those born survived to adulthood. Thus, despite the fact that even more vast millions of slaves were taken from Africa to the Islamic countries of the Middle East and North Africa over the centuries than to the Western Hemisphere, there is no such black population surviving in these Islamic nations today as the 60 million people of African ancestry living in the Western Hemisphere. The treatment of slaves in Southeast Asia was generally considered mild, in keeping with the use of slaves primarily for domestic purposes in that part of the world. However, in assessing the treatment of slaves, and especially in comparing that treatment as between Western and non-Western societies, considerable caution is necessary. Because of the moral revulsion against slavery that developed in the West, and especially in Anglo-Saxon countries, a large polemical literature emerged, both attacking and defending slavery. Biographies and testimonies of escaped slaves made a major impact, as did the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, which caused Abraham Lincoln to refer to its author as the little lady who started the Civil War, and which caused Queen Victoria to weep as she read it. Such literature and such powerful emotional, moral, and political reactions were peculiar to Western civilization. Neither the morality of slavery nor the treatment of slaves was an issue of such magnitude in non-Western societies. As a result, there is much less first-hand information on the actual treatment of slaves in non-Western societies. What happened in the privacy of slaveholding households was inherently less observable than what happened in the fields on slave plantations. In some parts of Asia, for example, slaves were expected to prostrate themselves before their masters at home. Among fellow Africans enslaved by the Mende, it was the practice to cringe up and place their hands one on each side of their master's hand and draw them back slowly without the fillet while the head is bowed. In a traditional African society where age was accorded great respect, aged slaves were treated as if they were still not yet adults. In the Middle East, wives of slave owners could be brutal to slave concubines who were or seemed likely to become his favorite, and who could, under Islamic law, become another wife, whose children would be entitled to share the inheritance. Such slaves might be beaten, mutilated, or forcibly aborted against their will. How often this happened will never be known. Nor can anyone ever know how concubines felt about being made available to male visitors. Yet the statements of non-Western slave masters that slaves were treated like members of the family have been uncritically accepted by scholars who would never accept similar self-serving statements from slaveholders in the antebellum South. The end of slavery. After lasting for thousands of years, slavery was destroyed over most of the planet in a period of about one century, and over virtually all of the planet within two centuries. The destruction of this ancient and worldwide institution was all the more remarkable because it was accomplished in the face of determined opposition and cunning evasion at every level, from the individual slaveholders to the heads of nations and empires. Moreover, the impetus for the destruction of slavery came not from any of the objective, material, or economic factors so often assumed to be dominant in history, but from a moral revulsion against slavery which began in the late 18th century in the country which was the largest slave trading nation of its day, with highly profitable slave plantation colonies, Great Britain. Slavery was so deeply entrenched and seemingly impregnable when the anti-slavery political crusade began among evangelical Christians in 18th century Britain that the most fervent crusaders among them hoped only to be able to stop the continued enslavement and international trading of human beings. Any thought that the very institution of slavery itself could be abolished was considered utopian. Yet the mobilization of public opinion in Britain against the slave trade produced such powerful and enduring political pressures that successive generations of British governments found themselves forced to push the anti-slavery effort further and further toward its logical conclusion. First to abolish the international slave trade, then to abolish slavery throughout the British Empire, and finally to pressure, bribe, and coerce other nations into abolishing slavery as well. The Quakers were the first organized religious group in Britain to repudiate the institution of slavery and to impose on their members a requirement that they not hold any slaves. But the larger political effort to get the slave trade banned by government was led by others inspired by the Quakers' example. This worldwide political revolution against slavery began with a small and rather conservative group of evangelicals within the Church of England, staid people who distanced themselves from the emotionalism of the Methodists, and whose principal leader, William Wilberforce, was such a relentless opponent of the radical ideas arising from the French Revolution that he sought to have those ideas stamped out in England by government censorship. Among the other members of the inner Clapham sect that began the crusade against the slave trade was the very reserved and dignified Henry Thornton, wealthy banker and a landmark figure in the development of monetary economics. Yet these were the leaders of a movement whose achievement was one of the most revolutionary in the history of the human race. Seldom was there a group of revolutionaries that so defied stereotypes in a crusade that defied the odds. Repeatedly and resoundingly defeated in Parliament on bills to abolish the slave trade, Wilberforce, Thornton, and their supporters persisted for 20 years until finally, on February 27, 1807, the House of Commons passed such a bill, 283-16. It was a remarkable victory from a mass mobilization of public opinion, and once mobilized, this public opinion proved to be so strong, so tenacious, so enduring, and ultimately so irresistible, that the anti-slavery crusade was swept along beyond its original goals of stopping the international trade in human beings to abolishing slavery itself throughout the British Empire and eventually throughout the world. Once the moral issue seized the public's imagination in Britain, its support spread far beyond the particular religious group that initiated the anti-slavery drive. Socially, it extended across class lines, from the rich to the poor, from the working class to the titled nobility. In an age before mass communication, mass transit, or mass movements, people were astonished to see petitions arrive in Parliament with tens of thousands of signatures demanding an end to the slave trade. At one point, Parliament received more than 800 petitions within a month, containing a total of 700,000 signatures. The anti-slavery movement proved to be as unrelenting as it was widespread. British missionaries fueled the public's outrage with their reports from Africa itself, reports widely disseminated by a powerful missionary lobby in London. Not all government officials favored the anti-slavery cause by any means, and some in both the civil and military establishments resented the extra burdens put upon them by this cause, as well as the complications that the anti-slavery crusade made in British foreign relations. But the political pressures forced successive British governments to continue their worldwide opposition to slavery. Though slavery did not exist in Britain itself, it became such a factor in British domestic politics that candidates for political office felt a need to declare where they stood on the issue. By the mid-1820s, being pro-slavery was considered a political liability. British warships were sent on patrol off West Africa, boarding not only British ships to inspect them for slaves, but also boarding the ships of some other nations who had voluntarily granted them this right. By the early 1840s, Britain began to urge the Ottoman Empire to abolish the slave trade within its dominions. The initial response of the Ottoman Sultan was described by the British ambassador. "I have been heard with extreme astonishment, accompanied with a smile, at a proposition for destroying an institution closely interwoven with the frame of society in this country, and intimately connected with the law and with the habits and even the religion of all classes, from the Sultan himself on down to the lowest peasant." Britain was far in advance of most of the rest of the world in its opposition to slavery. However, its example inspired abolitionists in the United States, and the French government later abolished slavery in its own empire, and then sent its navy on patrol in the Atlantic to help intercept slave trading ships. Eventually, opposition to slavery would spread throughout Western civilization, even to despotic governments like that of Tsarist Russia, which stamped out slavery among its Central Asian subjects. The European offshoot societies of the Western Hemisphere all abolished slavery before the end of the 19th century, and the spread of Western imperialism to Asia and Africa brought slavery under pressure around the world. Outside of Western civilization, the anti-slavery effort was opposed and evaded, especially in the Islamic world. Repeated pressure on the Ottoman Empire led its government to decree a ban on the slave trade within its domains in 1847, even though this ban led, as expected, to discontent and revolt among Ottoman subjects. However, mindful of the opposition within, Ottoman authorities were not very active at trying to stamp out the slave trade. Eventually, the British government threatened to begin boarding Ottoman ships in the Mediterranean to search for slaves, unless the Ottomans themselves began enforcing the ban on the forbidden slave trade. Nor was the Ottoman Empire the only foreign government to feel the pressure of British anti-slavery policy. In 1873, British warships anchored off Zanzibar and threatened to blockade the island unless the slave market there closed down. It closed. A sharp distinction is apparent between the ending of slavery in Western civilization and in non-Western regions. By 1888, slavery had been abolished throughout the Western Hemisphere. Yet the struggle to end slavery, or even the slave trade, continued on into the 20th century in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. The British added naval patrols in the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf after the Ottoman Empire's formal ban on slave trading provided the legal cover for such intervention. Yet slave trading continued on land until after European imperialism took control of most of the African continent. Only then could the attempt be made to stamp out slavery itself. The difference between the Western and the non-Western worlds as regards the ending of slavery is perhaps epitomized in the words used to describe the process: emancipation, a once-and-for-all process in the Western Hemisphere, and the decline of slavery in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, where it was a more protracted process that lasted well into the 20th century. Even after Western hegemony extended into many nations of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, slavery continued in remote regions of Borneo, Burma, Cambodia, and other parts of Southeast Asia. Among the Islamic nations of North Africa and the Middle East, the abolition of slavery came especially late, with Saudi Arabia, Mauritania, and the Sudan continuing to hold slaves on past the middle of the 20th century. Mauritania officially abolished slavery on July 5, 1980, though its own officials admitted that the practice continued after the ban. Non-Western societies never developed the crusading zeal which led to the destruction of slavery wherever European power extended. Nevertheless, the national stigma of slavery eventually became a factor in the restriction or abolition of slavery in non-Western countries which did not wish to appear before the world, meaning largely the European world, as backward or uncivilized. Thus, the King of Burma took the lead in officially outlawing slavery in that country in the 19th century, though it continued to exist on into the 20th century. Siam began to crack down on slavery in the late 19th century under the influence of foreign opinion. The rise of nationalism among Southeast Asian countries in general gave an impetus to the effort to stamp out slavery in the 20th century in order to gain respect from the world's leading nations, which meant Western nations. In the Philippines, at the beginning of the 20th century, an American report on the continuation of slavery there was seen by Filipino leaders as a blow against their efforts to gain independence. Even within the Islamic world, which retained the institution of slavery longest, Westernized elites began to oppose slavery, whether out of conviction or out of embarrassment. In short, slavery was ultimately destroyed morally, though the chief instrument in the destruction was the overwhelming military power of the West, combined with the prestige of Western civilization, based at this juncture in history on its economic, scientific, and technological achievements. Ironically, after anti-Western views became fashionable among Western intellectuals in the late 20th century, desperate expedients of rhetoric were resorted to in order to depict the destruction of slavery by European civilization as somehow serving the economic interests of European powers. The aftermath of slavery. The economic legacy. What was accomplished by the enslavement of untold millions of human beings in countries around the world? No doubt particular projects here and there were the fruits of slave labor, but it would be difficult to make the more general case that slavery advanced the economic level of those societies in which it existed on a mass scale. The American South, for example, was by no means the most economically dynamic region of the country, either during or after the era of slavery. It was, in fact, the poorest. Brazil, which imported several times as many slaves as the United States, remained a relative backward country until the large-scale European immigration that began after the era of slavery was over. The slave societies of North Africa and the Middle East, which absorbed even more millions of slaves than the Western Hemisphere, lagged conspicuously behind the technological and economic level of the West, both during and after the end of slavery, until oil, not slaves, raised their standards of living in the modern era. In Europe, it was the nations in the western region of the continent, where slavery was abolished first, that led the continent and the world into the modern industrial age. In many parts of the world, slaves were luxuries, or at least domestic amenities, rather than capital investments intended to yield a profit. A large retinue of slaves was a display of wealth and power, whether in ancient Rome, China, Africa, Thailand, Tibet, or elsewhere. In regions where slaves were part of a lifestyle, and this included much of the Islamic world, it can hardly be surprising that slavery did not create any notable economic development. That was not its role. Moreover, even in societies where slaves were intended to produce profits for slave owners, it is by no means apparent that those profits played any major role beyond the current consumption of those slave owners. Some have attempted to claim that profits from slavery provided the investments that made the Industrial Revolution possible in Britain. But even if all the profits from slavery had been invested in British industry, this would have come to less than 2% of Britain's domestic investments during that era. Moreover, neither in Britain nor the Western Hemisphere was there any evidence that slave owners were such dedicated capitalists as to invest all or most of their incomes. Contemporary observers frequently characterized slave owners as self-indulgent or ostentatious consumers, often in debt, Finally, when the total cost of Britain's naval and military efforts against the slave trade for more than a century are added up, they are comparable to all the profits ever made by Britain from the slave trade in earlier times. In the United States, it is also questionable whether all the profits from slavery exceeded the enormous cost of fighting the Civil War, a war that would not have had to be fought if there were no slavery, even if its purposes were conceived in other immediate terms by those on both sides. Many other slave societies, which sustained no such staggering costs, also had no comparable profits from which these costs could be subtracted. Appalling as it may be to think of untold millions of human beings sacrificed for no larger purpose than the transient aggrandizement of others, that is what the historical record suggests. Among the many negative aftermaths of slavery has been a set of counterproductive attitudes toward work among both the slaves and their descendants and the non-slave members of slave societies and their descendants. "Work is for Negroes and dogs" is a Brazilian expression that captures a spirit bred by slavery and not unknown in the American South or among the whites in South Africa. Nor is this a purely racial phenomenon. Descendants of the slave-owning and slave-trading Ashanti tribe of West Africa have exhibited similar disdain for work. Free women in Burma were unwilling to do disagreeable work which had become associated with slaves. There were similar reactions by the Egyptian lower classes against doing work associated with slaves, and by the white lower classes in the antebellum southern United States against doing work associated with blacks, slave or free. Similarly, in Malaya, where manual labor was associated with slavery, an observer in Malacca said, "You will not find a native Malay who will carry on his back his own or any man's property, however much you may offer him for doing so." In Aceh, even those too poor to own slaves would hire a slave to carry things for them, scorning to do it themselves. A 17th century observer in Sumatra found all the heavy work in Aceh being performed by slaves from India, with the local people developing an aversion to performing even simple tasks. No Achenese would carry any load if he could help it. If he had no slave of his own, he would hire that of another, even if it was only to fetch the rice from a place 100 steps away. What was involved here was not mere laziness, but a positive sense of being above various kinds of work performed by slaves, or an aversion to any kind of toil or working under the direction of others, because these too were reminiscent of slavery. What a historian of medieval Spain called a puerile pride in idleness has not been confined to that country or to that era. Adam Smith commented on the disdain toward work in ancient slave societies. By contrast, immigrants from non-slave societies have arrived in various parts of the Western Hemisphere, often financially destitute, but without such handicaps in their attitudes toward work, and have risen above the native-born white populations of former slave societies, often through very different work habits, often commented on by contemporary observers. Selective migration and other factors may well have contributed to the ability of destitute immigrants to overtake native-born whites in the Western Hemisphere. But patterns of disdain toward work in slave societies around the world, going back to ancient times, are at least suggestive. The cultural legacy. While some have seen the slavery of ancient times as a necessary foundation for the leisured life of a Greek elite that produced Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the great dramatists, and such physical splendors as the Acropolis and the Parthenon, it is painfully obvious that no such contributions to world civilization came out of the antebellum southern United States, out of Brazil, or out of the slaveholding whites of South Africa. It would be hard to think of any cultural figure of world stature in any field who came out of any of these modern societies during the centuries when slavery flourished in them. The contributions of Islamic civilization to Western culture and to world civilization in mathematics, astronomy, philosophy, and other fields were more substantial. But these contributions largely antedated the Islamic conquests in sub-Saharan Africa or in southeastern Europe, from which the Ottoman Empire received such large supplies of slaves. In Asia, the relationship between slavery and cultural achievements was equally tenuous. Bondage was particularly prominent in Southeast Asia, rather than in the great civilization of China, from which both Asian and Western societies derived so much, technologically and culturally. Moreover, in Asia, as in the Islamic Middle East, slaves were more often an item of expense for domestic purposes or for personal aggrandizement, rather than a source of profits. Nations and empires which were wealthy and powerful often used that wealth and power to acquire slaves, among other luxuries and signs of glory, But that is wholly different from saying that the slaves created the wealth and power. Even for ancient Greece, the case that slavery was the source of their greatness is by no means unequivocal. While slavery existed in Homeric Greece, the numbers were limited, and later, in Plato's time, a wealthy man might own 50 slaves, a number suggesting a retinue of servants, attendants, and craftsmen, rather than a source of riches. Spartans lived off their helots, but it is Athens whose contributions to world civilization are still recognized after 2 millennia. In the Roman Republic and early empire, slavery was not as large a factor as in the later empire, after wars and conquests had brought many slaves under Rome's dominion. In a world where the capture of a city often led to the slaughter of the men and the enslavement of the women and children, the growth of the empire and an increase in the number of slaves was not unexpected. And though plantation slavery flourished in parts of the Roman Empire, that is not the same as saying that Rome's power and cultural development depended on slaves. Moral issues. For more than a century, economists have debated whether slavery was profitable in the United States. However, the terms of that debate have tended to be narrowly focused on the profitability of slavery to the individual slave owners during the antebellum era. But the social effects of slavery extend far more broadly in space and time. The moral dimensions of slavery are likewise a more complex issue than often assumed. Once the institution was in existence, and its origins antedate history, the issue was no longer whether slavery should have been created in the first place, but what the options were to all the generations born into a world where it was a fact of life. Those who criticized the writers of the Constitution of the United States for condoning slavery by their silence on the subject have a valid point only if its abolition was in fact an option open to them at the time, in a new country struggling for survival. A much larger and more powerful United States was shaken to its foundations by the Civil War generations later. Had the United States split over the issue of slavery when the Constitution was written in 1787, it is by no means clear that the North would have prevailed militarily, or that either region would have survived. Moreover, none of this would have ended slavery, but only sacrificed a nation for some futile phrases. As it was, the moral consciousness aroused by the struggle for a free society in fact led to laws in the North abolishing slavery, no doubt a small and not always consequential act, as slavery was never as widespread in the North, and Northern slave owners had the option to sell their slaves to the South. Nevertheless, some people received their freedom as a result of the anti-slavery feelings and abolitionist laws of that period. More important, in the longer view of history, these abolitionist statutes were a first step toward the abolition of slavery in the United States, and were in the vanguard of a far more general revulsion against slavery that would sweep across Western civilization in the century that followed. Those who see in history the working out of economic forces, and especially of economic self-interest, have struggled desperately to fit the abolition of slavery into that framework of preconceptions. Yet the plain fact is that slavery was thriving economically, as far as the slave owners were concerned, when the moral forces of the age brought this ancient institution under political pressures that overwhelmed both the domestic moneyed interest in slavery and foreign nations' fierce resistance to imposed changes in their whole way of life. That this moral crusade began in 18th century Britain, the largest slave trading nation of the age, with thriving slave plantation colonies in the Caribbean, further confounds the argument from economic forces and economic self-interest. An amalgam of moral and economic arguments has been used to urge reparations to present-day descendants of slaves in the United States. The economic portions of these arguments are the weakest. If the purpose of reparations is to share equitably the economic contributions of slavery to the present economy, then it would first be necessary to establish that there were, in fact, net benefits. If the country is on net balance worse off economically because of the historical existence of slavery on its soil, then there are no benefits to share, equitably or otherwise. A more plausible case for reparations is as compensation for the sufferings and degradations of millions of human beings during the centuries of slavery. Tempting as it may be to glide from uncompensated sufferings in the past to reparations to descendants in the present, the heritability of guilt is a principle without foundation and dangerously divisive in any society. If the heritability of guilt were accepted as a principle, not just as a talking point to secure immediate political objectives, then this generation of Jews would be justified in putting this generation of Germans in concentration camps. No one believes that, not Jews, not Germans, nor any other sane adults. No society could survive historical compensation as a general principle. Doing justice among contemporaries is more than enough challenge. The principle of compensation has yet another side. To say that one has been compensated is to say that things have been set right, but nothing within human power can ever set right the sufferings and degradations of millions of human beings all over this planet for thousands of years. Slavery can neither be forgotten nor forgiven, certainly not by those who never suffered it personally, and certainly not in exchange for money or other benefits. Such a political deal would rank with the cynical sale of indulgences in the Middle Ages. The mythology of slavery. The history of slavery, like so much other history, has been sucked into the vortex of current ideological passions and distorted in the process. The enormous disproportion between the vast literature on the enslavement of Africans in the Western Hemisphere and the sparse literature on all other slavery in all other societies around the world is just one symptom of this distortion. Moreover, the habit of considering only slavery in the Western Hemisphere, or perhaps only slavery in the United States, has led to theories and conclusions about slavery in general, which are plausible only within a limited context, and not necessarily valid even there. To explain the enslavement of Africans by Europeans, by things peculiar to Africans or Europeans, is to ignore the glaring fact that slavery was a worldwide institution, among the most disparate races and cultures, going back untold thousands of years. Clearly, other factors must have been at work to explain the existence of slavery elsewhere, and once those other factors are acknowledged, it becomes mere dogmatism to insist that factors peculiar to Europeans and Africans and to the period of the African slave trade must have been responsible for slavery in the Western Hemisphere. Another distortion of history is to assume a priori that social problems afflicting contemporary blacks in the United States are a legacy of slavery. Broken families, lower rates of marriage, and lower rates of labor force participation have been included among the social phenomena explained and excused on grounds of a legacy of slavery. In reality, most black children were raised in two-parent homes, even during the era of slavery and for generations thereafter. Blacks had higher rates of marriage than whites in the early 20th century, and higher rates of labor force participation in every census from 1890 to 1950. Whatever may be the real causes of the very different patterns among blacks in the world of today, must be sought in the 20th century, not in the era before emancipation. One of the incidental but revealing aspects of the attempt to project current attitudes and assumptions back into the past has been the practice among some American blacks of changing their family names as a means of rejecting a heritage of slavery and the slave names supposedly given to their ancestors by their owners. In reality, slave owners in the antebellum South not only did not give surnames to slaves, but actually forbade slaves to have surnames. Surnames implied a set of family relationships which had no legal sanction and whose existence was at variance with the slave owner's authority to buy and sell slaves or otherwise dispose of them individually as he saw fit. Slaves could be punished even for using such expressions as my sister or my mother. Nor was this hostility toward family ties peculiar to the antebellum South. Slaves in China and parts of the Middle East likewise had no surnames. Only relatively recently in Western history have hereditary surnames been used for any but the elite, beginning in the Middle Ages, and in Japan, surnames were authorized for common people only in 1870. Far from having surnames given to them by slave owners, slaves in the United States gave themselves clandestine surnames with which to identify and dignify their forbidden family relationships. These surnames were never used in the presence of whites. And in fact, even after emancipation, blacks born during the era of slavery hesitated to tell white people their surnames. The enduring tragedy of Africans enslaved in the Western Hemisphere was that they were introduced to the culture of the societies in which they and their descendants would live only at the lowest levels of that culture. Forming a substantial proportion of populations in many parts of the hemisphere, in some countries a large majority of the population, African origin people were seen as a potential danger by the whites and were accordingly denied access to education and other means of acquiring higher levels of Western civilization. Despite obstacles put in the way of their acquiring the culture of the society around them, blacks nevertheless acquired literacy at a remarkable rate. Most free blacks in the United States were literate as of 1850, and half a century after emancipation, so were three-quarters of the entire black population. most of whom had been either illiterate former slaves or their descendants. The importance of reaching higher levels of Western culture was demonstrated by that portion of the African origin population of the United States that was free before the Civil War, and who had greater access to education and other cultural exposure at higher levels than the plantation field hands. Such free persons of color and their descendants continued to predominate among the elite of the Negro population well into the 20th century. Their cultural head start had enduring consequences. Despite the desperate efforts of freed blacks to educate themselves after the Civil War and to find family members who had been sold during slavery and sent elsewhere, a segment of today's black and white intelligentsia excuses contemporary blacks who disdain education as acting white or who abandon their families, both patterns being represented as being a legacy of slavery, though blacks born under slavery or living immediately after emancipation did not exhibit this pattern to the extent seen today. For many critics of Western society, exempting blacks from the requirements of civilized life is a way of striking a blow against the West, regardless of its consequences for the black community. Whether forbidden to achieve higher levels of civilization during the era of slavery, or excused from achieving those levels in the late 20th century, blacks had been handicapped either way. Implications. The staggering sweep of slavery over thousands of years and the enormous variety of forms it assumed at different times and places are almost as remarkable as the scant amount of moral concern it aroused until the late 18th century in Britain and the United States. How and why this particular juncture in history produced a moral revulsion against slavery is much less clear than the confluence of circumstances which permitted this moral revulsion to drive a policy which resulted in the stamping out of slavery across most of the planet in a period of a century and a half. The mobilization of this moral concern into a political force that was both powerful and tenacious was historic in its consequences because of the military predominance of the countries in which these anti-slavery movements developed. More specifically, it was European imperialism which stamped out slavery over most of the world. Even in parts of the world which retained their independence or autonomy, the indelible stigma that slavery acquired in European eyes made abolition a policy to be pursued for the sake of national respectability, even in societies which had no strong feelings against slavery itself. The irony of our times is that the destruction of slavery around the world, which some once considered the supreme moral act in history, is little known and less discussed among intellectuals in either Western or non-Western countries, while the enslavement of Africans by Europeans is treated as unique and due to unique moral deficiencies in the West. Moreover, what is and is not considered to be a legacy of slavery is too often determined by what advances the ideological visions of today, rather than what accords with the record of history. Attempts to explain the choice of which peoples to enslave, or the treatment of those already enslaved, on racial or other ideological grounds, fail to account for the racially indiscriminate enslavement of whatever peoples were available for capture at particular places and times in history. It was not a change in ideology, but such historical developments as the growth of powerful nations and empires, which successively removed various peoples in Europe and Asia from the ranks of those whom it was feasible to enslave. Africa south of the Sahara remained vulnerable longer, and its peoples paid a terrible price as a result, though other peoples in isolated and vulnerable backwaters in Asia continued to pay a similarly terrible price, long after the descendants of African slaves were emancipated in the Western Hemisphere. The treatment of slaves also reflected economic and social realities, rather than being simply a function of racial or other ideological beliefs. Plantation slaves were treated worse than domestic slaves in societies around the world, regardless of the race of the slaves or the slave owners, and regardless of the prevailing beliefs. In societies where the enslaved population was large enough to be a potential threat, harsher treatment and greater restrictions, including restrictions on literacy, were imposed. Even in colonies under the same colonial rule, such as the Dutch Caribbean colonies of Suriname and Curaçao, slaves were treated much more harshly where the demographic and occupational patterns were the kind that tended to lead to harsh and brutal treatment elsewhere in the world. Suriname had plantation slavery, absentee owners, and a white population outnumbered several times over by the black slaves, and exceeded in size even by the small class of free persons of color. Curaçao, however, did not have the kind of climate required to grow plantation crops, so its slaves were mostly domestic, were treated more mildly than the slaves in Suriname, and were one of the rare slave populations in the Western Hemisphere to have a natural rate of increase, whereas in Suriname, the slave population followed the more usual Caribbean pattern by failing to reproduce itself. Manumission was far more common in Curaçao, where the instruments of torture used on slaves in Suriname were unknown. Although the slaves in both places were of the same race, and the slave owners in both places shared the same racial and cultural backgrounds, the different circumstances of the two Dutch colonies led to very different results. Circumstantial realities, not ideologies, were the crucial differences between the two colonies. Slavery and racial ideologies have indeed been related in many societies around the world. But to say that slavery was based on race is to put the cart before the horse. Where those who were enslaved were of a different race, that race has been despised, whether in Western or non-Western societies, and whether the slave or the slave owner had the lighter complexion. Slavery has therefore left a legacy of attitudes toward race as toward work, and both sets of attitudes have handicapped former slave societies, long after the institution of slavery itself has been destroyed. Slavery has, however, left little legacy of economic investment, especially in countries where slaves were a source of personal services, amenities, and public display, rather than a source of wealth. Even in countries where slavery was intended to be a source of production, as in the Western Hemisphere, the lifestyles of the slave owners often prevented either an economic or a cultural legacy from being left to the wider society. Slavery's most important legacy may be a painful insight into human nature and into the terrible consequences of unbridled power, as well as the inherent limitations of power as a means of accomplishing goals, even when those goals are pursued at all costs. Perhaps the most important moral legacy of slavery is a keener appreciation of freedom.